Thank you. Thank you for inviting me, Anne and Fabian. I'm happy to be here. I have been listening all afternoon, and my task was to discuss alternatives to traditional approaches to fertilizer recommendations. I've heard threads of many things I will touch on today, which means from the good side of it that we're all kind of thinking the same sorts of things, but from the bad side of it, it perhaps means that I don't have too much additional to add, but please stay. Paul will talk about how we're going to pay for it all in another 25 minutes, and so that's probably worth staying for. Okay. What do the following have in common? Moneyball, Art of Winning an Unfair Game, the PSA screening test, and vitamin E, or in general, multivitamins, and our use in society. Well, if you have been able to get your head out of your lab or get yourself out of the field and paid attention to anything in the news other than the din of the election that may or may not be coming sometime in the future and the Republican candidate roster, you will maybe have some idea of what I'm talking about here. But in general, these are all cases where, to a certain extent, disparate data were used in some sort of non-traditional aggregate to slay a few sacred cows. If you went to see the movie, I went to see the movie, Moneyball. I don't have time to read. I suspect most of you don't have time to read novels either. There's a great cuss and discuss scene, and it involves how to select a player to have a winning team win a pennant. And the criteria advocated for one key criteria is whether or not the girlfriend of the player is a looker. Because if the girlfriend of the player is a looker, the player has confidence, and therefore one will win a pennant. And that was one of the key pieces of dogma that the scouts looked at when they were trying to identify people to play. In the other cases that I've listed, the multivitamin case is an interesting one. There's a recently concluded study of 39,000 women in Iowa. So maybe this doesn't apply to women in Indiana, but I'd like to think we're not that different. And they concluded that multivitamins do squat for you, which is a relief to me because I don't take multivitamins. But the interesting thing was that they aggregated different sorts of data, including women who switched from being the control to taking multivitamins during the study. Okay, so that's kind of a violation of experimental design there. I picked the PSA screening test because, among other things, it is something we have a lot of comfort with. And everybody likes the notion you can have a blood test. Men like it. Women like it because men aren't so anxious about other things. And screen for risk of cancer. And again, it's a test that they've decided doesn't do squat, but they actually delayed the release of the information for a year because they were afraid of the controversy. And so that's interesting in and of itself. I think these all have informative lessons to tell us as we contemplate what we can or should do differently. And so let's get to the business at hand and talk about soil fertility testing. So back at it. Traditional approaches, these have already been discussed in detail, and so I'm not going to spend any more time on them than have already been done. What's the problem? This has already been discussed as well. For those of you who don't recognize Stan Barber, that is Stan Barber. I suspect many of you recognize his name, but he certainly did a lot for the world of soil fertility testing and was the major professor of some in this room. And the data that he got, they were excellent. Excellent data. There's question about whether it applies to modern production systems, but in a way, that too has some answers. I think the problem really is that, in general, whatever data we have on hand now has limited inference space. And you just can't get around that for, and this has been mentioned, for the myriad of systems that we're using on the farm, and at the same time we want to have greater specificity, and we have greater expectations for tailoring. These are all things that that have already been discussed. I think it's important that I need to point out that there are some areas getting money, and we should be a big player in those big science questions, because many of them involve nutrients and nutrient management, either directly or indirectly. But the money isn't trickling down. And I think it's in part because we're not well positioned to play. And I would go further and say that it's really about our current conventional, now current means the last 20 years, of synthesizing applied and basic research pieces into a big picture. This has already been mentioned as well. We have state programs, and we each do our bit, and we put our own results out there, and then we compare notes. And implicit in that is something I'll get back to, but we have an applied research philosophy where we own our data. We don't necessarily share raw data because it may not be interpreted, and we don't necessarily publish it in a place that currently has long residency time. So there's a lot of stuff that is in the gray literature. What is the problem with the gray literature? The gray literature is being flushed down the toilet by libraries as we speak, because they don't keep it on hand anymore. So if stuff is in the gray literature, it may be great, but we're losing it because of decisions that are being made that are beyond our control. I had a big debate with our former department head about keeping on hand some copies of those old recommendations, Dave, that you still have one or two of, and I try to keep two or three of everything just because. Not quite sure what it'll do. Okay, the bottom line is that we are a small science. That is not my descriptor. That is somebody else's descriptor of what I do. They told me I'm a small science. And it is about how we do science, and that is that we're kind of lone operators. And this is sort of in the, if you think genetics, in the context of that, we are small scientists. Our research objectives tend to remain discrete. We do something specifically for a purpose. We're done. We put it away. Our experimental designs remain fairly traditional, and for a myriad of reasons, we are inaccurately perceived as a downstream science, a maintenance science, easy, inexpensive, and we're not necessarily targeted knowledge that is going to be well used by biotech or something else, even though there's a strong argument that we are upstream or at least interactive. So I think the challenge, we know why we want to do it. We know that change is inevitable, and then growth in our recommendation process can be intentional. We know that systems are going to change. The question is how. And, okay, so roll back the clock. Create more of us so we can go back and do more of what we did. Can't do that without money, so perhaps the first thing that needs to be done is to pump bucks into the fertilizer recommendation research agenda, and then land grants will hire more, and et cetera. But the problem is we've lost our value proposition. So we don't really pass the laugh test when we go up administration and say what we do is valuable. And that's not necessarily our fault, but that seems to be the circumstances we're existing under. So we have to try to find something else that actually passes the laugh test. Where do we go? Well, I think there are elements, at least, that I've been thinking about and that I would like to see explored. These are not only the only elements, but I have thought about them a lot in the context of what I've been doing over the past few years, and I think they're worth exploring. Brad mentioned data. It's come up before. We don't have enough data. Well, even if we do have enough data, we're not able to access each other's data very readily. So there's a concept of distributed repositories that I'll touch on. We really don't have tools and workflows for disparate data aggregation, things like user-friendly interfaces, and key pieces that would allow us to work collaboratively on data and large data sets, and that includes citation for data sets, things like embargoing, proprietary data protection mechanisms, et cetera. Cyber tools exist. We haven't really harnessed them to our abilities. We know how to make web pages and do spreadsheets, but we don't necessarily do a whole lot more. We have not used our full statistical toolbox, and we don't really have, if we think about our recommendations as living organisms that we're going to constantly update, we don't have a framework for doing that. We tend to approach and say, okay, we're going to do this, and then we'll be done, and then we'll move on to something else. The bottom line is the systems will always change. So just to be perfectly clear, we do have a strong history of data sharing. And the North Central Regional case studies, I still have the white papers on the data. They're tremendously useful for looking at things like the effect of drying on soil, K release or fixation, that kind of thing. And they certainly were key foundational pieces for our current recommendations. I assume we can do it again, but the question is how? I don't think we can roll back and just simply say we're going to reinvent the old regional research project model and pump the money back into it rather than paying our salaries or whatever else that happens to it. Plus, the money hasn't expanded. The Hatch project money hasn't expanded. So, again, that laugh test issue, we're going to have to do something else. Okay. I want to kind of switch gears a little bit and talk about some other issues that are out there when we get together and we think about a different model or moving forward with data sharing. A big problem is our own issues about bad data. And so, you know, just quickly, what really is bad data? Bad data is data that you don't understand. It's not yours. If it is yours, it's like, oh, something must have happened. I don't understand it. It's not trusted. It's less understood, perhaps not for the purpose at hand, and probably just not well described in your understanding. So by contrast, good is mine, trusted, well described. You perceive that you understand it. Maybe it's new versus old. And maybe it is specifically for the purpose at hand, and that matters. I'm not sure we can afford to have those biases anymore. I think we have to look at what we consider to be bad data, and can we characterize it and use it in a way within its own limitations to help our purpose. Okay. All right. Just to give a little touch in the real research world on why I'm so interested in doing something different. I've been doing field research for 15 years on K, not quite as long as Antonio in Iowa, but we have a lot of K data. The intent was to look at the recommendations and whether or not they worked or didn't work. But the problem is, it's not the same thing to say, you know, that a recommendation doesn't work. That's not the same as identifying what will work. So it's much easier to say this doesn't quite fit, but it is not an easy proposition to say what's better. And this is just a simple example. We can look at the elemental build values, and we can look at our data and see whether or not things match at different locations, and they don't tend to match very well. And indeed, if you look at some of Stan Barber's older data, maybe it doesn't match so well either. But that's not the same as implementing a new recommendation, or that's any better than what's already out there. So this is, you know, it's easy to take stuff apart, it's easy to throw stones, it's not very easy to assemble a building or something like that. So a major philosophical discussion going on right now is what do you get, given the current system, from one more site year of data if you don't have something different in place? And I think that's a really important question. Another example is the bioenergy, where you've got lots of discussion about new crops. This was mentioned. We don't have much information on they're out there as being discussed as low carbon footprints, and they have improbable yield potentials with very low or very low nitrogen use, very high end use efficiency, and there isn't the science underneath, and there's a huge need to ratchet up the science fast. So how are you going to do that? Well, you got to have a different model. You can't just all go along on your own. And the model that we've sort of been kicking around is one where we integrate disparate data and allow other people to come in with big ideas that we can't think up on our own and, you know, come in with a different perspective and do some analysis. Incidentally, this idea that was hatched a while back, I think with IPNI in a proposal a long time ago, we've been scooped. This was published in Science, was essentially the same concept for ecological data about what is needed. And basically, the point is cyber and cataloging tools exist. The barriers are money, motivation, and mechanics. So Paul's going to solve money for us, and then we'll work on motivation and mechanics. Actually, the money will motivate, and then it's just down to mechanics. So, and the challenges, other than cultural, which is we do have a history of data sharing. We don't necessarily have discipline, but we share data. I mean, discipline in our data management, but we do have a history of sharing. But there is a problem with data dispersion, heterogeneity, and provenance. So in the few minutes I have left, I think I have a few minutes, I want to talk about a couple of the key ideas. We have a happy happenstance in that we're not the only discipline experiencing the need to find opportunity and threat. Libraries also need to find opportunity and threat, and so they are looking at evolving from documents to digital data. And this is very timely for us because it gives us the opportunity at looking at their informatician cadre of people to help us do what we want to do. And we've had lots of discussions about collaborations with libraries, with the National Ag Library in D.C., which has some stated objectives, including the becoming the repository for all switchgrass data. That was an initial early stated objective. And we're looking at mechanisms where data are curated and preserved just as documents are. Along the way, this is my, you know, access to raw data. Our data are not accessible in part because we don't have the money to make them accessible, but we also don't have very good data habits, and I've been told that by our informatician friends. The bottom line is because we can't move from where we are, we're losing data daily. So we've got to do something else differently, or we're going to continue to have data kind of fall off the plate and disappear. So Brad brought up what I would call data standards. So this is also protocols and how you do things. And then an array of informatics tools are needed. Right now, raw data aren't shared, and that's my file cabinet. And I'm not going to share that with you because you wouldn't understand what the heck it was. I couldn't just hand it to you. And Mangela asked for a lot of my grain concentration data, and I hemmed and hawed because, you know, it's like opening my file box and saying, look, see what you find. And that's not what she was after. When we get right down to it, these same issues that were highlighted by the ecologists are what we are challenged with. Dispersion, we want to take advantage of lots of us all over the place doing relevant related work. We may not all do it the same way, two scoops, one scoop in the soil test, I don't know. But if we know that it's two scoops versus one scoop, that's important. We can decide whether two scoops or one scoop matter. We can decide whether soil type matters in Indiana versus Iowa. And then provenance is a really interesting question because there was a mention of policy. And provenance becomes important when our biological or any kind of biophysical data meet policy. And we've seen this with the climate change group. And if you don't know where the data come from, you don't have a leg to stand on when somebody attacks you. And that seems to be the name of the game. And I had an interesting experience. If we look at a grain metric that might be relevant because it involves nitrogen, and that is greenhouse gas or carbon equivalents versus grain yield, And we're looking at that as a decision point whether a system and a management, a nitrogen management, are a good idea. You can see lots of places where provenance problems may come into play. One of the problems we've encountered is simply giving data to my ABE colleagues at Purdue who want to model, use the SWOT model. They didn't understand that all the data we were giving them on yield was at 15.5% moisture. They assumed it was at 0% moisture. And it wouldn't have come out if we hadn't sat down looking at spreadsheets and like, what does this mean? We're like, well, the calculations are there. You got to open up the different columns and you'll see. But it wasn't annotated and it wasn't there in black and white. That's a pretty big difference in there when they're looking at validation. If you're looking at something more complicated, like a carbon footprint that has nitrous oxide embedded in it, you might want to take an IPCC calculation, or you might want to actually take measurements. And I think this is being discussed in the nitrous oxide emission protocols or whatever that are considering being adapted for Iowa and Illinois. If you are going to make measurements, there are whole sets of levels between which there is room for error and interpretation, and you have to track, just like your materials and methods, you have to track what you did. How was it calculated? How was it measured? And so that's when you get right down to it, the critical questions for whether or not this value is defensible in a policy context are if you've tracked the methods, the protocols, the level of, you've made a decision about what level you're going to share and archive, and that you document the QAQC in the process both before and then after that. So if somebody tries to do something different with the data, it's documented. And that all comes down to, I labeled it number four, but that's data provenance and attribution. Where did it come from? What did you do with it? And how did you get where you went with the number? And that is a huge issue, and it's actually not easy to do. So seamless provenance traces apparently are a hot topic for research informaticians in all areas of informatics, not just what they might do with us. Okay, I mentioned we've been studied. Our group has asked the librarians to come in and study us and the cyber people to come in and study us. And that's where my statement about we have lousy data habits comes from, because they've told us that. And they've, you don't need to read the small print, but basically they decided this was the sort of process they would need to go through to help move us from disparate data that can't be used by other people to pieces of data that are usable by modelers or whatever, and then in the end they want to demonstrate how it can be used more broadly. But basically there's a whole process of auditing, assessing, annotating with metadata, documenting standards, using controlled vocabulary. Critical level is a critical level, right? And then how you store information that makes it reusable and retrievable. Okay, couple additional points. This all sounds like a lot of work, but the bottom line is that when you get further away from the data that you want to use, and this is obvious when you make the statement, you have to become more systematic. So while it's fine for me to know in my head all about my own data and have very kind of dynamic ways of capturing data where I tweak protocols and I adapt them, I add new data to my data set, I keep my knowledge within the group, that's fine. But if somebody else is going to use my data, I've got to get away from that. Things have to be versioned and stable in terms of the sets that are out there and the documentation. You can't just change it willy-nilly. And you have to come to an agreement about what you're doing for key pieces of data. And it has to be explicit. You can't assume anybody's going to understand. Okay, wrapping up quickly. Whose data has potential? Well, I think we need to look beyond just ourselves and look at aggregating data from people who are doing other things, including farmer networks, where the data aren't quite the same, but there's still data, there's still information coming from different landscape positions and systems than we can afford to study. Some bad data are going to be inevitable. The idea is that you have to have enough to see the forest for the trees when you're looking at them in different ways. You have to have mechanisms to understand other people's data better, including excluding data you don't trust. So if you don't trust my data, you got to be able to exclude Brudere's data from your analysis. And, you know, I probably want to do the same thing. And then you have to be, once you get this sort of set up, it will allow you, and you will need to use different statistical tools. It doesn't necessarily tell you what the answer is. We'll still cuss and discuss, but it'll give us different things to cuss and discuss about. Okay, what does that fifth thing mean? Framework. Well, beats the heck out of me. But Brad mentioned getting out of our, we are products of the past. And human condition is sticky mental models. And I learned that because I had to go to a visioning thing, and they talked about sticky mental models. So, yeah, okay, we trust what we know. And so, getting out of our sticky mental model. That great thinker, I don't know who it was, for Moneyball, it was a Yale economist. I don't know if we need a Yale economist, but maybe we do, to help with thinking. So, some concluding thoughts. How do you eat the elephant? How do you get started on something that we're not doing? Well, you got to pick a starting spot. Maybe it's a specific nutrient, maybe not. Maybe it's a specific problem. But I don't think you can try to do everything at once. I have a preference for K because I don't know what to do next with all the data that we have, and maybe Antonio feels somewhat the same. What data? I haven't talked at all about that. Who pays and who plays? There has to be some system that gets this out there, and there has to be some ongoing support. Who owns data remains a critical issue, but who pays for the maintenance for this sort of thing? That's what everybody always wants to know. If you build something, administratively, who's going to pay? Is this easy or is it hard? IT says it's easy until you start, the cyber infrastructure, until you start talking to them or they about what your problem is, and they're like, oh, that's hard. And so it's someplace in between. It doesn't mean it's impossible. My perception, getting back to baseball, it's not a field of dreams. We can't just build infrastructure and hope it works. This kind of has to be a collaborative effort to get this going. It's also not an iWidget. We can't expect somebody from Apple to come and hand us a tool that we never knew we needed and have it be perfect. We're going to have to contribute to the development, tailor it to our needs, and make it go. This is what Dave's point was at the very beginning. Need people creative thinking. I think data done right in our discipline is our avenue into some of these bigger, to become the player we know we need to be in these bigger questions. And so that's where I'm going to end it, because I think we are big science. It's just how to make it so, or perceive to be so.
Thank you.
No questions.